You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 321. And on the program this week, I will be speaking with Gaëtan Heroux. Gaëtan is a longtime community organizer in Toronto and has been working with unemployed, low-income, and unhoused communities for many years. He has been particularly organizing recently with a project called 230 Fight Back. This is a challenge to a major real estate developer in downtown East Toronto that wanted to demolish a set of low-income homes, previously places where working people lived, and build a condo tower. There's been a protracted battle around these plans in downtown Toronto, and the campaign has succeeded at certainly holding up the project and really pushing forward the realities of the housing crisis in Toronto and how mass condominium developments, which some organizers in Toronto with 230 Fight Back have been calling a mining of the sky. So it was really meaningful to sit down with Gaëtan and speak about his organizing work with 230 Fight Back. And we recorded this conversation in Toronto this past winter. So here is our exchange. Today, in many cities around the world, we are seeing extreme levels of both wealth inequality, but also a profound housing crisis. Toronto is no exception. Many districts central to the city have faced extreme gentrification in the last decades. At the same time, there's really important community-based organizing taking place in a lot of these neighborhoods. One important example of that in Toronto is 230 Fight Back, which is in the downtown east. I'm in Toronto with Gaëtan Heroux, who is one of the organizers of this process, of this project. And I want to talk to you about some of the recent creative actions you've been involved in around this initiative. But I think first it's probably important to sort of like situate us or locate us a bit. So if you could just introduce yourself and talk to us a bit about what 230 Fight Back is and sort of why it's come forward at this particular time in Toronto.
So 230 Fight Back is an organization that was created directly as a result of a private equity company that bought a property in March of 2022 that we had been, that the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty had been advocating that the city buy. So it was put up for sale. City bid on it. They were outbid by Kingset Capital. So when we found that out, 230 Fight Back, we revived the campaign. And just to give a sense to people of, you know, if you were to go to Dundas and Sherbourne, just a little south of Dundas East on the west side, you'll see an empty lot in an old Victorian rooming house that was boarded up. The lots used to have three other rooming houses on there. For decades, they housed people in our neighborhood. We're located in one of the poorest, one of the oldest working class neighborhood in the city. Historically, the unemployed have always come, you know, way back when this industrialization happened. They came back, they were coming here and all that kind of stuff. As a result of all that, a whole infrastructure was set up, including like those rooming houses, a whole bunch of this stuff. So right now what's happened is today as we're fighting, so the rooming house that we're talking about that's still up right now but boarded up has become a symbol of the city's housing crisis. It has become a symbol of developers' greed, and our work right now is to continue to fight for it to be, you know, given to the community so we can build social housing on it, and to sort of expose the city, the councillors, the bureaucrats, and the developers around, you know, their responsibility of what is happening at that particular lot. and we've had a number of actions. So the property has a big fence around it that you know, stops people from going on the lot. Last summer, we actually had a block party at Dundas and Sherbourne, but we took down a part of the fence. And then everybody came in, we served food, we had music. We were there for about 2.5 hours and stuff. So it was a really nice action. And for the first time in since 2008, the lot was being used, you know, by the community to talk about what was going on in Nice. Inequity. This summer, again, because of this fence, which, you know, when we walk by, which I've always found annoying, and I'm always trying to, we're always trying to wrap in our head, what are we going to do with this fence? You know, it's just obstructing us from doing. So one of the ideas was to put padlocks on the fence that would have messages on it. I think the event was called "We Won't Be Locked Out."
Nice.
So what we did is we bought a bunch of padlocks. We had a bit of a debate about how many we should buy because we knew they might not last long and stuff. And it was a fun debate in terms of I would argue for, you know, that I wanted to buy 200 padlocks. Somebody in the organization would say, well, do we really want to spend that much money? So we came to a compromise. We did it. So we bought these padlocks. Then we painted them all like nice red and green colors and bright green colors. And
why
then
these colors?
Well, the red was just. They're bright, and plus red is the color that we use for 235 back. So we did that. So and then we had messages that we put on them, and then we brought some of those padlocks so that people could write their own messages on it. So they were names of people who died. They would talk about the fact that, you know, we needed social housing. So we had another kind of similar block party where we came, we did that. We had various organizations join us from Parkdale, No Demolitions, and actually the York Southwestern Tenant Union also came to speak. It was a really nice event. People really enjoyed it. So the locks were put on, and they were very visible. So that was the idea, that people would go by there and go, well, yeah, what's going on here, right? So if they went a little closer, they would see the messages on the lock, and they did that. The locks were... So one of the ideas was also, along with this, was that we saved all of the keys that we had for the locks. We put them in a jar, and the idea would be is that we would deliver those keys to Kingstead Capital at the Scotia Plaza on their Thursday, because we figured they would need, they might need those keys to, if they wanted to take them off, I don't know. So we paid for that. But before we could deliver the keys, they hired someone to cut the locks off, and we have a picture of the person they hired cutting the locks off and stuff. But we still went over to Kingset and again delivered the keys in a letter saying we want you to continue to do that. On the same day, that afternoon, we actually went to a committee room where an organization called CreateTO, the board of CreateTO, which is responsible for all of the properties in the city. Huge, billions of dollars. And the guy, the CEO, his name is Vic Gupta, was there. And so we went there. We had about 25 people. And at one point, we got up and we demanded a meeting with CreateTO because they would be involved in buying the property.
Yeah.
We shut down the meeting for about 15, 20 minutes. They sent a representative to us, agreed that they would arrange a meeting. And we've had that meeting since then. We're going to have a meeting with the housing secretary of Ontario next week, actually. So over time, since we started this campaign over 3 years ago, it's had many shifts in terms of, because when we started, you know, this was in the fall of 2022. We had nothing. We had no money, no bank account. We just formed a new group, right? Except we had the history, which was the most important. We began to write articles. We began to have events. We began to look for people in Parkdale, like-minded people. How are you being affected by these developers buying properties in your community? And we ran into no demo eviction in Parkdale and some people in Regent Park, you know. So, and we began to make these connections,
yeah.
And that's been really, really helpful. The big development was in 2023. Throughout that year, Kingset offered to sell the property to the city, and there was negotiations going on, but in the end, they couldn't agree on a price. So right now, where we're at is, which is really interesting, is last fall, the city approved the application for a 46-story condo development on the site. And also, there was a motion there that if they could negotiate with Kingset to build some sort of affordable housing or buy them, that they would continue to do that. Although we found out that hasn't been going on. But what's happened since then is that in Toronto, but across Canada, is the pre-construction condo market is dead in the ground. It's gone. They can't. Nobody is building new condos. So Kingset right now is stuck with a property that they can't develop for the next 3 or 5 years, that they can't sell. The price of the land, they paid $53 yeah. million, dollars, is now half worth about $30 million. So all of these dynamics are there. And we're saying, we're meeting with the city and housing secretariat and CREATO, saying now's the time where you make your move. And if they won't sell, just expropriate. You can't allow, that property's been sitting empty now for 17 years, since 2008. It's vacant. And anybody who knows Dundas or Sherbourne would understand that you're in the epicenter of the housing crisis in Toronto. Like, yeah. you can't miss it. So to allow that property to sit empty or vacant for that long, and you just say now that, you know, it's going to sit empty for another 3 to 5 years, is criminal. It's unacceptable, and our fight now is again with the city and with Kingset, and saying, yeah.
So there's two intersecting points that I would want you to kind of follow up on here, if possible. The first is that I think for some people hearing this who are not familiar with the dynamics in Toronto, they would be probably surprised. I'm just talking about a basic sort of image of Toronto, that there's remains. A lot of space relatively close to the downtown core where people are either struggling with finding housing or they're being pushed out of housing. So sort of the realities of that particular district of the downtown east in Toronto, just an image for people to get a sense. And then just folding back to the very first thing you said, which is financialization and speculation, and you passed over that pretty quickly, but I think it's pretty important just to sort of underline that a lot of the crisis around housing in Toronto has revolved around that, right? Like just around this sort of speculative process, and folks like the current Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, they're connected to that, right? I just want to note that for anybody hearing that we're talking in Toronto, it's January 2026, and we're in a restaurant, so you're hearing a bit of noise. Yes, Gaetan, go ahead.
So in terms of the displacement of, so historically, Dundas and Sherbourne, the downtown east, is an old working class neighborhood. It always had low income people living there. Beginning in the mid 1960s. The gentrification of the neighborhood began. The some of the wealthier, more affluent people began to come and buy up some of the old Victorian houses that were being used as rooming houses and as what we used to call flop houses. And these things were there as a result of a whole bunch of people leaving the area, the wealthier people leaving the area after the Great Depression. So that began. And then what happened is when the big developers came in, like Kingset Capital, Mankez, Pemberton, when they came in the neighborhood, then large displacement of people began to happen. But also when these companies came in, they then made the Dundas unaffordable. So let me give you a good example. So if you know, I don't know if people know Toronto, if you go along what we call the corridor, the Dundas Street corridor, let's say from Sherbourne to even to Yonge Street, in the 1990s, used to be called Dundas Square, has a new name now, was developed. And the idea was that they would create what they have in New York, Times Square kind of situation. That began to open up the corridor, and people began to speculators began to buy along the corridor. So right now, or a couple of years ago, there were about 11 projects and they were going to build, by the time those projects were finished, there was going to be over 6,300 condos along the Dundas corridor. And that meant that area was gone. It was no longer affordable. And the reason for us at Dundas and Sherbourne is important, and why 214, 230 is important, it's the last corner to be developed. Because if you go further east, we've had a situation where, you know, beginning 2005, the whole redevelopment of Regent Park happened, yes. Right? Which is important to the puzzle. Because once you opened up, or got rid of Regent Park, the whole corridor now, well, the whole area, the value of the land just skyrocketed. Just to give you an example, when we were pushing in 2018 for the city to buy 214, 230, the market value of that land was $18 to $19 million. That was in 2018. When they sold it, like 5 years later, they got $53 million for that from Kingside Capital. And everything in around that now is also worth, at the time, was also worth the same. But right now, like, as I mentioned, there's a crash. There are four major developments within a couple of blocks that are dead in the ground. There's one where the Grand Hotel used to be. It's an empty lot, just like 214, 230. There's the Fillmore that's been bought up, and there's also across the street another development. All that is dead. What does that mean for the neighborhood? In the end, we don't totally know, because we're not sure what the future will bring. But what we do know, what we're arguing, is that the city has a responsibility to make sure that particular corner, but that neighborhood, Dundas Sherbourne, that has to remain affordable to people that want to come and live there. And that's the fight that we're fighting right now. So just a quick word. A lot of people sometimes ask, what do you mean by finalizations of housing? So I think for me, the education of researching Kingset Capital. So Kingset Capital is a large equity company that has properties across the country. They work primarily by getting money from often from pensions, and they would use that to develop the site, and their plan is to, again, they found the money, I think it was from RBC, $72 million, to develop the site. The next step for them is to get money from the banks to build the project. In order to do that, they need 70% to sell 70% of their units, and they can't do that right now. And so these companies right now are buying up properties in poor neighborhoods. I've been doing that for the last 10, 15 years, and are building housing that is built purely for speculation. Purely for speculation, not meant to be lived in, So right now we're seeing the consequences of that nobody wants to buy this, they can't sell the condos, and a lot of people said, yep.
Well, the point that comes to my mind in relation to your work that I think is important to underline, Gaetan, is, I mean, you're connected to different anti-poverty organizing processes and also just frontline work in the city. You were very involved in the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. And just thinking about, like, there's this sort of, like, analysis point that you outlined around Kingset Capital and other processes around financialization. But I think the Project 230 Fight Back and others that you've been connected to are interesting for many reasons and important for many reasons. But one of them is that there's that sort of confluence of being connected to directly to the communities that are affected by these questions, right? And I think one of the challenges that is often faced when we hear people sort of offering like a structural analysis, let's say, of financialization, maybe from an academic framework, which is important. Sometimes there's some, you know, very good analysis coming from that context, but there's a disconnect with people who are maybe living those realities. So I'd just be interested from your point of view as a community organizer, making that bridge between having this sort of overview, economic and political analysis, while also being on the ground and connected to the community impacted, why that's important.
Well, historically, I've been working in the downtown suburban area since 1988. And I've got to know a lot of people over those years. I've known actually many people who lived in these four rooming houses at one point before they were torn down. And have seen with my own eyes, the poverty and the destitution that you see it on a daily basis. Yeah. People will tell you, and particularly around the housing situation, the fact that other than needing TTC tickets, the biggest question is I can't find housing. That's the common theme and stuff. And as you watch, those four rooming houses disappear, immediately the impact that it will have on people. We now have like 15,500 people in the shelter system. When I was working, in OCAP in the 1990s, there were 5,000 people. And since then, we've lost a lot of the housing, and so now we have a situation where, I remember running into a woman when I went to the meeting place. We were organizing for an event and stuff, and she knew me, and she worked at a reception for meeting place for I think the last 20-25 years, and she said, "Gaetan, do you know where I can find housing? I'm past 65. I can't retire because I don't have enough money to find housing." This is somebody who's working, who's on a pension, will be on a pension if she retires, but she can't find housing. And we're seeing more. How should I say? So the issue of the housing crisis is much broader than the work that we were doing, in OCAP in the 90s and onwards, when we were focusing a lot on the shelters and the unhoused and all that kind of stuff. It's a much, much broader issue than that right now. The whole issue of encampments is a national issue. The country does not know what to do with its unhoused people. They have no clue. So what we're seeing at Dundas and Sherbrooke, and what we've seen for decades, is a situation that has worsened. It's a housing crisis that they do not know how to eliminate. And I haven't touched on this, but our work with 235 back right now, our research and stuff, we've basically found out now that the counselors and the mayor and the bureaucrats are implicated in this crisis, because they're the ones who rubber stamp KingSett's application and all the other applications, right? They're the ones who say, okay, we're going to give you permission to this, and they always say, well, if we don't, the province. No, they have to take a stand, and we've had many fights with some of the councillors, including Boyce, around the fact that he should say no to crisis. Because everyone knows that we don't need a condo tower at the Dundas and Sherbrooke. It will not do, it will do nothing to address the housing. It actually make things worse. It'll complicate the things, make it harder. It'll make the area unaffordable. They're making the whole area unaffordable, displacing people. And we're seeing the results of that, not just through the encampments, through displacement, and we're seeing across various low-income areas across Toronto.
For people who are interested to learn more about this campaign, what's the website of 230 Fight Back?
Well, basically, if you go 230 Fight Back, you'll find it'll come up, yeah.
Gaetan Huru, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much.
I want to acknowledge we're here in Toronto. My friend Kazem Tirmizi is here. We were at York University for an event, and it was really great that you could be here today, Gaetan, and share your perspectives. Thank you so much.
That was a conversation with community organizer Gaetan Heroux, who works with 230 Fight Back in Toronto. This is a particular battle around a mass condominium development that has been challenged significantly by activists pushing forth the realities of low-income tenants, unhoused communities, and the working poor in Toronto, a community that does not get a lot of attention when we think about and hear about the landscape of Toronto. Thank you to Gaetan for being a part of the broadcast this week, and also to my friend Kazem Termizi for being present during this conversation recorded in Toronto, and also for the invitation to speak at York University at the time when this conversation was recorded. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. You can hear us weekly broadcasting on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. If you'd like to listen, just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.